Thank you very much, Mr. Vice Chancellor. Thank you for the honor you do me by allowing me to be here and to present at this distinguished forum. Ladies and gentlemen, yes, that is the Library of Alexandria, and I do hope that you will all come and visit sometime. I have a lot of material to cover in these 40 minutes, so I intend to say a few words about the prologue, and then this should be the seven pillars, not the seven pillars of the knowledge revolution, and then implications for education-related institutions, something about how I think the educational process itself is going to change, and then conclusions about the university. So every time you see a red slide like that, you know that I'm starting a new section, and I'm getting closer to the end. So I'm going to use a lot of slides, so fasten your seatbelt, as they say, and let's go. The main point I'm going to also emphasize is that the human brain is not only an amazing thing, we understand very little about it, but we know that we are very good at processing visual information, but also at being able to construct abstract ideas. And the ability to handle abstract symbols allowed us to invent writing. So, I mean, we have letters, then words, and then sentences, each of which is one level of abstraction built on the other, and we reinterpret them. And that allowed really knowledge to accumulate, broke conventional evolutionary processes. But I believe that now we are on the cusp of a profound knowledge revolution in the very structure of knowledge. And it's the biggest thing since the invention of writing. And I will marshal my evidence to that very big claim. Just generally speaking, data, when it's organized, becomes information, and when it's explained, becomes knowledge. But that is not the same thing as wisdom. As I said in the Mandela lecture, those who invaded Iraq had a lot of knowledge, but not necessarily wisdom. And science, and the scientific method, brings data, information, and knowledge, but we really need the humanities to help us evolve the dimensions that enable us to have what we call wisdom. Now, the main thing is that the biggest invention that allowed human civilization to rise was the creation of writing. It allowed knowledge to accumulate and to be transferred across space and time, intergeneration and otherwise. Whether it was in stone or in clay tablets or in papyri or in scrolls, as we know, or by the invention of the codex. Actually, after the invention of the codex, it became the preferred format. Whether it was in manuscript form or printed form didn't matter. Production allowed by printing allowed the mass production of a book as a commodity, so to speak, but it didn't really change very much the fact that the knowledge was still encoded in writing, in pages that are bound in a codex, and therefore passed in particular volumes and cumulatively, like building a wall where you can see the bricks of the walls one next to the other. Today, electronic books are here, but they're still, this is another way of carrying the same material. I suppose, like many of you, I have my Kindle, my iPad, and my e-reader. But today, we're still relying very much in our scholarship on the notion of books and the classical presentation of knowledge. Now, that's a carryover from there, but the ICT revolution that we are witnessing, which is quite recent, has really begun to erode and transform that. The most transformative innovation, actually, in fact, of the whole world, I think three people have really changed the world more than all the politicians and the military leaders combined. Here are two of them, Bin Cerf and Bob Kahn. They're not very well known, but they are the real inventors of the Internet. The TCP/IP, which is the fundamental protocol of the Internet, and this man, Tim Berners-Lee, who is the inventor of the WWW, the World Wide Web and HTML. Now, these three together, I think, have transformed our lives in ways where we can hardly imagine what it was like when you couldn't access something called the net. And the Internet is anything and everything and it has had an explosive growth in the last 20 years. It transcends political boundaries, and it allows us, of course, to communicate at the speed of light, literally at the speed of light, around the world with emails and now with tweets and other means. But the enormous amount of information available on the internet is of very variable quality. Some of it is absolute hate and garbage, and some of it is pearly gems of wisdom, and some of it is enormously valuable scientific information. And the new technology is also unleashing creative ways in which new knowledge is being either created or utilized. So I'll give you just quickly two examples of that. The first, my good friend Jimmy Wales, the proud founder of Wikipedia. Now, the idea that you could get 100,000 people who don't know each other to collaborate on an academic project and produce an encyclopedia in about 5 years was totally unthinkable in the last century. It is literally a product of this new century. And it challenges our conventional way of organizing academic committees to review encyclopedias. It is the most used encyclopedia in the world. This is in the Library of Alexandria, in one of our halls. We are promoting Arabic Wikipedia Day, and we're getting all these young people to contribute to reviewing and correcting articles in Arabic. The other one is the BA Science Supercourse, which we did work with WHO initially in the University of Pittsburgh to produce PowerPoint lectures like these that are given for free. They're put on the web for free, and we distributed them in DVDs like that initially. And these lectures are about, this is in the case of epidemiology, we have 3,600 lectures from Nobel laureate like the late Joshua Lederberg to young assistant professors. And 60,000 teachers use them. They can take any pictures they want or entire lectures if they want to reach about 1 million students in 175 countries. And it's in 34 mirror servers and 90 million hits a year. And all of that for free. Now, this couldn't be done. And now, working with Vintcerf and Gil Omen, and that's Ron Laporte who did the epidemiology part, we're trying to expand that to cover all the other sciences as well. And it's just the beginning of many alternative possibilities. The idea is that you could do all of this was not conceivable 10 years ago. Literally. Neither Wikipedia nor all of that was conceivable 10 years ago. So it's really an amazing beginning. And it's just a beginning because the net itself, the web itself is changing. Web 1.0 was basically somebody produced material, put it on the web, and somebody read it and became a consumer. Web 2.0 is where we are, where everybody is both a producer and a consumer. We all go to the web for lots of things, and we all post a lot of things, from blogs to YouTube to Flickr to email. We add a lot. So everybody is both a producer and a consumer. The semantic web, on which Tim Berners-Lee and some of his friends have been working now for over 10, 12 years, is a possibility of, instead of searching the web through objects, which is what we do now with our search engines, we'll be able to address the issue of linkages between objects and concepts rather than specific objects. And that should take us a huge step forward to move from a web where we are. Now, in parallel with that, we've had another explosion. Also, all of that is less than 10 years old. It's really remarkable. Facebook has been a phenomenon. As somebody said, it would be the third largest country in the world in terms of population, over 500 million adherents right now. And it's a form of social networking. Now, here, Nova Spivak has done this very nice diagram that shows that this is the original web. And on this side, degree of information connectivity, and on this side, degree of social connectivity. So if you go up from the conventional web, you would end up with the semantic web, which connects knowledge. This one connects information. And as you move here, you're connecting people. The question for her is, what happens up here? When you connect knowledge and you connect people, are you in fact getting to the area where you can connect a collective intelligence? Just as people were able to do Wikipedia as a collective output of knowledge, when you have a semantic web and a lot more people, do you get a different kind of phenomenon, and does it become the meta-web, as it's called here? I don't know, but certainly more change will come, and beyond tomorrow, who knows what will happen, except that I lean back to the master of American poetry, Robert Frost, who said that now I am old, my teachers are the young. What can't be molded must be cracked and sprung. I strain at lessons fit to start the suture. I go to school, to youth, to learn the future. And this is very much what this lecture is all about. So let me go to what I diagnose as this new knowledge revolution, which I think is very profound, and it has seven major characteristics. They are intertwined, so the purpose of splitting them is merely a matter of convenience to talk about them. You cannot talk about it, as we talk about many other facets of things, we do separate them for convenience. So just to remind you that the knowledge, the method, the technology is all intertwined together. And these are the seven characteristics I want to talk about. And the first of these is the idea of parsing life and organization. Life of the document of the knowledge base. What I meant to say, a document is dead or alive. Actually, what I mean by that is that if we have the same book together, and you and I open page 157, and the first line will be exactly the same in your book as it is mine, and when 10 years from now it will still be the same, and 30 years from now it will still be the same, and in fact it will be the same until there is a new edition of that particular book. On the other hand, if I refer you to a website, and you go there 2 hours later, the website may have changed because it's being constantly updated, it's alive. The sources themselves that we refer to right now are alive. And they're constantly being changed and updated. So the very phenomenon of where you go for information is changing. In addition, the structure and presentation of scholarly argument that has been honed over time and really more or less frozen since the 17th century, early 18th century, where you start with first of all, you're creating a document either by hand or by print, which is pretty much a dead document in the sense that I explained right now. You have an introduction, a problem statement, a methodology, you marshal evidence, you do analysis, interpretation, you draw conclusions, and then we have our references and bibliographies and ways of adding the links to these other parsed bricks in the structure that we're talking about. Well, today the document is alive, it can be updated constantly. We don't think in terms of the structure, we think in terms of a web page, a home page that is connected by hypertext links. Hypertext, incidentally, is a technology of 1992, so a lot of changes can be expected. There'll be sitemap, search, browsing, etc., a whole new array of restructuring the presentation of knowledge, the codification of knowledge in a way that is changing. And what's more, we now have images and videos as part of the reality of the same website, which we didn't have in the classical book. Tomorrow, the parsing, which has already been reduced by the web, pages and hypertext will become, I believe, almost continuous. All documents will be alive, and underlying concepts will become part of the semantic web. 3D images and videos will become something that you draw regularly out of your machines and look at them and see them and turn them around and so on. It will be very fluid. The entire system will be alive, not just individual documents in it. And advanced searchability and browsing across the semantic web means that concepts as well as objects will interface, and language will no longer be a barrier because machine translation will be accessible. And all of that is not very far in the future. So the structure of knowledge will be changing, and we'll have this fluidity, and there you can see the new hypertext structures that exist, the semantic web that's coming by. And beyond the conventional keyboards and screen as an interface, we have already augmented reality, and we have providing information when and where it is needed, such as sending it to the PDA or the handheld or the smartphone of a doctor in an emergency room so that they don't have to go back to look at the patient's file in a record room, in an archive somewhere. It can be sent to them digitally, and all of this already beginning to happen right now. So the knowledge that was parsed in individual volumes is now becoming a living, vibrant, changing, interconnected knowledge base that's constantly alive, and now across the whole planet. Now, what does this remind me of when I look at that? First of all, that knowledge will be much more like a river, a flowing river, that's never the same when you sample it from the same spot at any moment. And at the same time, it's much more fluid and continuous and not a structure that is built brick by brick the way we used to think of it. In fact, imagining that is almost like imagining a human brain at the planetary scale with neurons firing in all sorts of directions, where the results of all these firings are difficult to imagine from a long distance away. Second transformation is the role of image, image and text. Until very recently, for obvious cost reasons and technology reasons, image was not the way we conveyed information. We conveyed all our information almost completely by text. But increasingly, anybody who doubts can see people taking videos with their phones and putting them on YouTube and the Flickr and so on. This is how we do it. Now, this has very profound implications. Our human brain has evolved to be a much better processor of visual information than we are at interpreting text and abstraction. So imagine briefly opening a door into a room for a fraction of a second and closing it again. In that fraction of a second, you can describe the room, you can say whether it was oval or square, whether it was high ceiling or not, the color of the walls, whether it was chandelier hanging, what furniture existed, six people were in it, two women, three, four men, whether the chairs were leather or metal, the color of the carpet was red or green. All of that you processed in a matter of a fraction of a second. Now imagine trying to convey the same information by text. Now, you lose a lot, obviously, in terms of speed and efficiency, but you gain something else, because in the text, there is an interaction, and the reader of the text helps create the image, and it's never quite the same. It's a collaborative process, and that's why we say texts are produced by author and reader together. It's the difference between reading a good novel and watching a movie made from the novel. It's not the same. The experience is different. So anyway, today, I think we will increasingly rely not just on image, or image plus text rather than just text. So you can look at these pine cones or read the description of them here, whichever. Clearly, looking at the color picture of the pine cones is much easier. It has many positives, including, for example, this is something we did at the Library of Alexandria, three-dimensional X-rays, which we can rotate like that so the doctors can look at. You can look at subatomic structures in ways. You can look beyond visible light through infrared imagery, temperature-controlled imagery, which you couldn't do otherwise, which can be used for diagnosing feelings of pain and illness. You can do things which you couldn't do with text. I mean, this is a Tokyo subway, but New York subway, Paris subway, London subway. Can you imagine trying to describe it by text? You couldn't find your way around it without the image. I haven't been in space, but I am in space vicariously with the pictures that the astronauts take and the videos that they take, so I can relate to that. I can see entire cities in a way that I couldn't see before. So images bring us a whole range by which they expand our understanding, but they use less of our interactive capabilities. And that's part of the new reality. That's going to be a lot more image and a lot less text in proportion to the total amount of knowledge. The third part, that troubles a lot of people, but as I say to everybody, it's not good or bad, it just is this, that with the exception of pure math and some questions in philosophy like what is the meaning of life and what is the purpose of the universe, every other field of knowledge, every single other field of knowledge I can think of, humans will need machines to access, retrieve, manipulate, and add to the body of knowledge. You will no longer be able to have a Newton sit there or an Einstein sit there and write his equations on a yellow pad with a pencil and by themselves. Even if you look at the social sciences, if you look at literary criticism, you would want to know who did what in which university, and you can't find that information except by using the mediation of machines. So we are entering a new age where, and I did my PhD thesis, I spent days and days of great happiness going around the stacks in Widener Library and browsing all these books and taking one by one and reading and all this interaction and searching, and that was wonderful. Now I could probably do what I did in 6 or 7 months of searching in 2 weeks, less maybe a week, with internet searches and speed searches and other things of that nature. We used to laboriously copy things down on 5x8 cards. Now you just select, copy, paste, etc. But it's there. It's happening. And you will no longer be able to advance knowledge without the mediation of machines. On one level, it's going to expand our brain's reach remarkably than what we have. And this will also allow, I think, technology and science to interact and transform each other much faster than they've been. And by that I mean that we have a spiral that starts with current knowledge, new discoveries, new technologies, new discoveries, new technologies, new discoveries, etc. And that science-technology spiral is becoming faster and faster. An example, a very easy example of that, the new biology. No human being could write down 3 billion letters and then write another 3 billion letters and then compare them and find one, what we call a single SNP or single nucleotide polymorphism, difference of where there's a mutation of a particular gene. Couldn't be done without computers. So entire new branches of knowledge have been developed, and now our understanding of genetics is changing, and as a result of that, we're developing new technologies that apply to genomes as well, and so on. Question, well, with all this interaction with machines, what's happening with artificial intelligence? Good question. Deep Blue defeated Garry Kasparov, world champion, in 1997. That's already 14 years ago, almost 15 years ago. And where are we going next? Well, will there be an emanating intelligence coming up? What I can tell you is that today, to this day still, human brain is about 1 million times more powerful than the most powerful computer. However, the question is, what happens when computers who are becoming more and more powerful will become 1 million times more powerful than human brains? I don't know. But I know we're going there. And I know that this intimate relationship that we're developing right now, where you cannot deal with knowledge without the mediation of machines, is going to become much more intensive as we go along. The fourth pillar is the fact that our life, our world is increasingly complex and chaotic. And I'm using these in the scientific term. So the science of complexity is a complex system. They're not linear system. They have multiple overlays, and chaotic in the sense that predictions are very difficult. And you can look at a few examples from weather phenomena, for example, which are extremely difficult to predict. You know, you can more or less predict that the winter is going to be colder than the summer, and you can more or less predict what's going to happen in the next 48 hours or so. But beyond that, a week, 10 days, 2 weeks is extremely difficult. That's the nature of a chaotic system, which means that it has nonlinear feedback loops in a complex system of multiple variables. And nobody could tell you, you know, on the 23rd of August, the day will be like that, the weather will be like that. It's extremely difficult to do, and that's part of the Lorentz attractor. That's another story we want to get into, but these are, in fact, mathematical probability spaces or possibility spaces that are allowed by particular equations. But there's an emerging science to this, and it requires also different kind of geometries than the one we've learned to use so far, which, for example, we use for architecture and engineering, for very beautiful three-dimensional work like that, for complex designs, for design and decoration, but all our mathematics and geometry. We can produce the pyramids, but we can't describe the clouds. We don't have the tools to describe the clouds geometrically and mathematically. They're changing there. And it's quite impressive that we need a new geometry for life and nature. Our geometry could not describe or draw a single flower. or to describe or model the flowering pattern of an entire tree, or the patterns of leaves, or the beauties of corals, until Benoit Mandelbrot, who just passed away last November, came about. He was working at IBM with the ideas of the fractal geometry of nature, and he said, look at how the shapes are produced, not what they look like at the end. So if you take the Nautilus, for example, and try to describe that shell, well, the mathematics of describing how the shell came about when you think about it is not that difficult. In fact, we can produce it in the same way through this volute. And we finally discover self-similarity, that a wave, if you take a little part of the wave, it's basically a smaller version of the big wave, and so on. Mountains were very difficult to simulate in computer graphics until fractals came along and we could do this afterwards. The first people to like that were the artists, who generated very beautiful designs, because small recursive equations can actually produce very complex shapes. And I believe that these concepts hold enormous promise for understanding social systems and other systems as well. They have self-similarity, they have multiple outcomes, they have nested hierarchies, and this is the Mandelbrot set. They have infinite variety with repetitive forms. You can keep zooming in like that, and then, whoops, you're back again to the Mandelbrot set, and it can go on indefinitely. So fractals offered new things, and they have incredible applications. Already we can do something on the growth patterns of plants. We can look at the patterns of flowering. We can describe the cracking in drying earth. We can look at the structure of DNA. The path of lightning bolts is described by fractal geometries. And the snowflake formation, or the turbulence in gases, which is extremely difficult to explain. Patterns of coastal erosion, organic constructs, and of course, neural networks. Now, the great turning points in our understanding also developed new mathematical tools. Newton had to invent calculus. Einstein had to use non-Euclidean geometry and tensor analysis. And therefore, in our times, I think we're going to see a new mathematics develop. Whether it's these new tools or other new tools, I don't know. But I do know that we will have a new mathematics fairly soon within this century, by the middle of this century. Now, computation and research is also very important. We've advanced by making collections of data. We had data collections. We did a lot of data collections. But now we are trying to build connections between collections. That's a very different task. And it requires an enormous new capacity to manipulate knowledge and to understand, organize very vast amounts of knowledge that can't be done without the tools of computer science. Now, to be fair, until recently, all the computer scientists and the geeks, as they were known on campus, were sort of, you know, these are the backroom boys. They're the people who just, somebody who fixes the chalkboards and so on, because the machine is just a calculator, very fast calculator, but still a dumb calculator. When you want to start thinking about how to build not just collections of data, but connections between collections, where do you go? Well, who's been thinking a lot about databases? Who's been doing a lot of analysis on databases? Computer scientists. And that's not all. For example, information theory. People are saying, if you really want to understand the cell, the functioning inside the cell is really an information system where it's encoded in DNA and detected by RNA, and then it tells how to assemble the amino acids into proteins and so on. So it's a flow of information, and maybe you can model it through information theory. Well, who's been working on information theory? Computer scientists as well. So I think that the new paradigm will see novel math and statistical techniques. We'll see computing science concepts and tools, as well as computing platforms that will be generated as ways of connecting different disciplines who are working in the area that I will refer to in a moment as convergence and transformation. Where will this lead to? Well, already we see new computer architecture, new pathways, clusters, network controls, neural nets, multidimensional manifolds, virtual communities, and a lot more. But what I do know is that we also are nowhere near the frontier of that, because there's efforts to deal with DNA computing and with quantum computing that are opening entirely new things beyond the expansion, linear or exponential, of the silicon-based approaches that we've been used to so far. So Because of that, I also expect that we are going to witness a lot more convergence and transformation. And by that, I mean that sciences come together. The easy example of that, we had biology, we had chemistry, and now we have biochemistry. For a long while, there was something at the interface of the two, and that's where it's happening. Now we have bio-info-nanotechnology, which incidentally in Arabic stands for girl, bint, but that's, bint is girl, but actually it's bio-info-nanotechnology where it's merging together, and this is where it's very exciting work is being done. And secondly, we have transformative research. At the National Science Foundation, I worked on the committee for 3 years where we're trying to figure out how to assess transformative research. For example, the most powerful example of transformative research is the discovery of the structure of DNA. Now, biology before is one field, and biology after is a totally different. And that has produced genomics and structural genomics and functional genomics and the new cell biology, molecular genetics, proteomics, metabolomics. All of these fields have been produced by that transformation that came about from that time. The question is, can we do a lot more in that? Well, what we do know is that the most exciting such transformations are going to happen between these new disciplines in these convergence areas. Now, very quickly, you can already begin to see where we're going with universities, because we're not particularly good at interdisciplinary research involving multiple departments, where the hierarchies in each department reinforce particular disciplinary structures that have been inherited from the past, as opposed to inventing new structures for the future. But that's just an example. The emerging new fields are there. The last thing on these seven pillars is pluridisciplinarity, and that means that because of the complexities and that we're discussing, any possibility of dealing with our world, whether you're dealing with economics or sociology, or you're dealing with environment, you're dealing with gender issues, you're dealing with the new sciences, all of that requires the insights of the social scientists as much as the natural scientists, as well as the wisdom of the humanities to help us shape policy. And as these enormous explosions of knowledge occur, we have to be able to find ways of bringing these people together so that they can each bring their contribution to evolve a more and better and more humane society. So there you have this revolution, which is just beginning to take shape, and where I think the results of this revolution are going to be as profound as the original invention of writing, in shifting humanity's relationship with its world, its vision to itself, of itself and the rest of the world differently. So the implication for education, from kindergarten to postdocs, research, universities, public and private labs, and supporting institutions like libraries, archives, and museums that are the supporting institutions of knowledge, are all going to be very profound. If you look at the implications, for example, of archives and libraries, old-style archives, actually much better than the ones in Cairo. New style, new forms of storage, but this is the new form of storage. And in fact, the Internet Archive that I'm proud to have a copy of, because the original is in San Francisco, this is storage. Old style retrieval of information, new style information retrieval. And the conventional organization of knowledge that we used to have in Leipzig, the Dewey Decimal Classification, you know, this was inherited from the, I have to open a parenthesis, Max, if you allow me, just to tell you the story that this was at the time of my predecessor, the third director of the library, Eratosthenes, in the 3rd century BC. He invited all the great scholars who were there, including Archimedes, who came as a visiting scholar. But he had as one of his resident scholars the greatest poet of the Hellenistic period, a fellow called Callimachus. And Eratosthenes, as a good director, as a good rector, as a good vice chancellor, must say, you know, he said, poetry is all very nice, but get on with it and do something useful. So write a catalog produce a catalog for the library. And this is 3rd century BC. Callimachus, for the first time in human history, organized universal knowledge by field. Organized universal knowledge by field. And then manuscripts were there by the authors in each field, and then he organized the authors alphabetically by their names. And he invented bibliographies and library science. And from that time, little has changed, actually. We've improved a lot in terms of efficiency, quality, keywords, etc., systematization, but the conceptual structures are the same. Now the world is changing. This is a map of the new knowledge produced by the New York Times. And I think there are different ways, and I will see it. I'll show you some of the work of Eigenfactor in a moment. Because as more and more stuff gets digitized and people access it digitally, they build different kinds of connections between fields than the conventional somebody coming there and saying the 300s are going to be this and the 400s are going to be that and do a decimal classification. So Google's big digitalization program is really contributing to a new form of global knowledge where everything will be online, everything will be at our fingertips. Now, I am still a bibliophile, and I am very, very sad from this picture. But, hey, it's happened. This is October 2010, the first bookless library in the University of Texas in San Antonio, College of Engineering. They removed all the books from all the shelves. Everything is digitized and linear, and they have 425,000 books and 18,000 journals. And they're all online, and librarians go around silently with their iPads and answer the questions of people. I like books, so I feel sad. I like the book as an object. I like the feel of a well-bound book and the smell of the paper. But that's happening. And this is more recent, but it's also happening. E-book sales topped paperbacks for the first time on the 15th of April. And for those of you who know the United States, apparently yesterday or the day before, Borders bookstores just closed. No more book sales. They're all going to be electronic now. So e-books are now there. So it's, the predictions I was making when I was putting this together in 2010, and I used to say, this is within the next 10 years. Well, it's happening within the next 10 months. It's beginning to happen. Some of it's beginning to happen right now. So the digital future is really unstoppable. And we have to think of new collaborative ventures. Now, that was the negative side, but the positive side is really great. And the two examples are the World Digital Library and the Encyclopedia of Life. The World Digital Library was the brainchild of Jim Billington at the Library of Congress, supported by UNESCO. And we collaborated on it. And the idea is to take the best of the cultures of all the world, including the Timbuktu manuscripts, and whether they're manuscripts, pictures, maps, etc., all put together. And we in the meantime, had done work on something called the Memory of Modern Egypt, which looks like that. It's really like a mini single language WDL. So we had an agreement to work on developing the core base of that, which we launched in 2007. And then we did the official launch in April 2009, and the World Digital Library, which you can visit at wdl.org, looks like that. There's a timeline here. You can restrict the timeline that you want to look at. You can look at particular regions and areas, but you can also choose the language you want. You can browse by type of item. So if you go here, for example, this is a book about Cossacks. You find similar items here and so on. You can open the book itself, or you can change the language. In this case, it's Portuguese. Or if you change the language to Arabic, for example, you get it changes sides because the Arabic reads from right to left, not from left to right. And all of that is done automatically. You can zoom in on maps. You can do by topic, by place, by time, by institution, by cluster. And the contributions are coming from 95 libraries from 63 countries. And therefore, we're creating something where everything is posted, but where the best in each place is posted and curated by people, responsible people in each place. That's the WDL. It does something that could not have been done without these tools. Fine, rather than say, we're so sad about the books, well, the bookless library, now we're looking at something else and seeing how it's done. Now, the Encyclopedia of Life is another example, and that's closer, because if the Wikipedia was done in one way, a Wikipedia, you could imagine if it was all printed, be an encyclopedia. The Encyclopedia of Life really reflects the parsing and the new structure of knowledge. It's a collaboration between the top museums, natural history museums, and the top libraries of the world. And you start with a website. This is the home page. And then behind that are what we call the species pages. So every scientifically described species will have one homepage, its own homepage. 1.8, now 1.9 million, of which about 40,000 are now finished. That's what it looks like. Picture, information, classification, etc. for all fungi, the pine cones, viruses, every creature will have its own homepage. And then behind the homepage are about 600 million pages of scientific text that you can access from the species page or directly by itself. It's called the Biodiversity Heritage Library, and is a collaborative venture, looks like that, that involves all the top, about 18 of the great libraries of the world. So this is a structure very different from a conventional encyclopedia, the Encyclopedia of Life. The magnitude of the project could not have been conceived of until now, but more importantly, the structure itself reflects the new structure of the homepage and connections and so on, rather than in terms of a text in itself. Museums will also need to change the way they present things. They will have to find new ways of presenting information that is dramatic, three-dimensional. But above all, there is no reason why, if I'm sitting at a museum and I'm looking at an object like this one, for example, and I can't say, well, I would like to see what other objects like it there are, and immediately it will bring me in 3D form, and I can even take them out and turn them around and look at them. This one is in the Louvre, this one is in the Benin Museum, this one is in South Africa, this one is in New York. Doesn't matter. We can have 3D images of them connected. We can have a breadth and variety that didn't exist before, and new ways of interaction between the individual that is there. So all of these changes are now, not tomorrow. For education, I think the old model of kindergarten, 12 years, 4 to 5 years of college, which you get a certificate to practice for 40 years and then retire, is not workable. And we're going to have to need continuous learning that is modular, additive, and diversified from preschool and school, because we have a new generation for whom growing up with computers is like breathing air. This is a school in preschool in Germany, and this is a preschool in Egypt. And what's wrong with this picture? I think it's a terrible picture, and what's even more terrible is that the teacher was proud of it. What is terrible is that these little girls are being constrained, their desks are empty, there's no sloppiness, no interaction. They are being disciplined, they're not being taught to enjoy learning. Look at this picture, how much better you can see the enjoyment of learning there and the sense of discovery that comes with young minds. The question is, how can we in fact transform our educational system so that all these budding young minds, about 200 million of them who are coming into school age right now around the world, will get their chance, rather than in schools where there is not even a place to sit on, as this picture which we took in certain parts of the Sahel, or this rote memorization approach which you can see in this image. And this takes us to the all-important tertiary level of education, where the gross tertiary enrollments, in fact, between high, middle, and low-income countries grew for most of the time, except that the countries that have really taken off have shown a different pattern. So this was sub-Saharan Africa, excluding South Africa, low- and middle-income countries and high-income countries, looking at 30 years that preceded this century. And this is Korea. Now, we all know Korea, Singapore, and so on. So the importance of third-level tertiary education is very important. But from kindergarten to postdocs, all aspects of education will change in terms of content. And before I get to these four aspects of it, I think it's very important that we reach everybody. We are wasting an enormous amount of talent by not giving the kids their chance. So in terms of content, will rapidly change, but we need both the humanities and the sciences. There is this emphasis on somehow, you know, we have too many people who are reflecting on philosophy and law and not enough on science and technology. Maybe true, but we certainly don't want the opposite either. We want participants that are going to be lifelong learners with different milestones at different stages of their life, but fundamentally, whatever you learn today will be obsolete 10, 15 years from now, so you have to relearn all the time. Teaching methods, we have self-learning is going to become much more important. Guided learning, distance learning, as we said, is also appearing. And instruction, which is the preferred method that we've been using so far in everything from schools through universities, has got to be reduced. So it has to be complemented by all these other forms, encouraging this what-if questioning all the time. The organizational settings will be many institutions, real and virtual, many offerings, plus enormous flexibility in participation. And the university has done some rethinking. Now, if you're not very francophone, you would not necessarily know the CNAM. The CNAM is the Conservatoire National des Arts et Métiers. It's a very prestigious old organization, 200 years old. It has its own virtues and so on. This was at the time of my honorary doctorate there, but they retained all the gowns and so on. But they were revolutionaries from the day one. In fact, when the Americans wanted to invent MIT, they sent a delegation to study the Conservatoire National, because it intended from the beginning to say, we are not the ivory tower, we are going to be somehow connected to the transformation of society. Well, the CNAM today has decided to transform itself, rather than just producing graduates, to have 70 locations where 100,000 part-time continuing students are going to be the priority of the university. Maybe that is something in the future of all universities. But the idea is that, okay, so you graduate somebody, but within 5-10 years they will need something else. So they've created these 70 locations around France right now. So that gives me the pieces for the university of tomorrow. We need a new system of tertiary education, as we said, the old 12 plus 4 plus 40 years, then retire. Diversity of structures and offerings. You will have small and large institutions coexisting. They can be equally excellent in different fields, like Juilliard School of Music and Harvard. Lots of part-time students, and because they will be interacting with society. Centers of excellence will continue to be needed. Private labs will collaborate with universities increasingly, as private sector plays a bigger role. And many other institutions will participate, like museums, libraries, and so on, like we saw in the Encyclopedia of Life. The frontiers of science are going to be pushed back, but there will be two-year colleges, standard four-year universities. There will be allowances for breaks, travel, work, coming back to education, multiple universities, to this, giving the same unified degree like the Erasmus Mundus program in Europe, where students go to take one term here, one term there, from several European countries before they get their degree. And we're now talking Erasmus Mundus, do it around the whole world, so that they could do a four-year or three-year program in six different countries and learn a lot of different things. Accreditation will be handled by external bodies, and flexibility and lifelong learning will be there. The governance will maintain the autonomy of the universities as a community of scholars, and we should find adequate financing for all deserving students. Emphasis on the word deserving. Not everybody, but anybody who's talented should have a chance to go forward. And the essence of the university will continue, the sense of community, the participation that has been honed through years of tradition, and the committee structures that exist in universities. Linking to the market can exist, but should not be at the expense of this very profound university dimension itself. Professional schools and certificates will be constantly under review. The idea that you give somebody a degree in medicine and they can sort of continue to open up the bodies of people for 25 years on the same amount of knowledge, relying on them that they will be reading and learning the latest, somehow I think going to also change. Modular upgrading for job skills will be available. The links to the economy will be with R&D and cluster startups, but we need centers of excellence. Now, this is important for developing countries. Here, I don't count South Africa as a developing country because it's already very advanced in its institutions. But in India, for example, the centers of excellence that exist there were criticized by some of the scholars. Why in a country that is so poor are we spending so much on these graduates? But they stayed the course and the country has benefited. I think the new library is one such example, and I've constantly asked, why are we not spending that money on eradicating illiteracy in the fields? I said, well, we should need to do both. These centers of excellence, in fact, in the United States, receive the top 100 institutions out of some 2,500 institutions, receive $22 billion of the research grants compared to $5 billion for the rest of the universities. And they account for almost all the academic patents. And What we need to do in developing countries is to recognize that we need both centers of excellence and a broad-based approach. And how do we do this? Well, I say the difference between a human being and a chimpanzee is less than 1.2% of DNA. And yet, that is what produced everything that we have seen as humans, our poetry, our technology, our science, and so on. And to a country's cultural, educational, and scientific base, these centers of excellence are the equivalent of that 1.2% of DNA. They make all the difference between uniform mediocrity and the ability to transform a society and go forward. So centers of excellence are needed even in the poorest countries. And those that are too small to have one can group together. I mean, countries like Togo, Benin, and so on, Guinea Bissau, who are 800,000 and a million, 3 million, can do something else. We need to have a focus on science and technology from university down to high schools, down to primary and middle schools. We need to nurture, recognize talent early and nurture it in societies. And talent, I mean, my friends in Brazil were telling me some of the most talented mathematicians come from some of the poorest barrios. But they had these Olympics that they used to do in these exams, and they found the kids who are very talented and are able to draw them forward. And in all we do, we need to teach the values of science. That means a total adherence to truth. Scientists, anybody who fabricates evidence, the data is absolutely ostracized. You can make a mistake in interpreting it, but you cannot fabricate it. Can you imagine the same standard of rigor applied to the media or to politicians? Or honor, plagiarism is not accepted. We value creativity and imagination. We allow a constructive subversiveness because we expect that Einstein replaces Newton and that others will replace Einstein. And that's how science advances. Thus, we have to have a tolerance of engagement with the contrarian view. And we have a method for arbitration of disputes between scientists on an evidentiary-based approach. Now, these values are forged by teacher example and student practice. And they are humane societal values, not just for the production of science, but for a better society as a whole. And the University of Tomorrow must uphold these values as it diversifies everything else at the same time. Now, this new map of knowledge that you saw earlier on, instead of the fixed old departmental groupings, we can actually do something different. This is done by Eigenfactor. This is the definition of the social sciences as seen as how actually social scientists use the material. Now, you can begin to see certain parts coming together in very different ways than was conventionally departmentally structured before. This one is for the natural sciences, and you can do more. The digital future is here. Bioinformatics, for example, feeds from many different, takes from many different sciences and feeds many different sciences. And we have a lot more. So graduation will have a different meaning. Graduates will not remain chained to the same career choices. Careers will involve many changes as people go along, some involuntary, some voluntary, so there will be many choices. Our graduates will be pulled in all directions, and they shall find their way. I'm very confident in youth. The purpose of the university and its ultimate goals will remain unchanged. Search for truth, intergeneration transfer of values, learning to learn, certification, creation of new knowledge, and encouraging lifelong learning. But as T.S. Eliot said, we shall not cease from exploring. And the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Because it's going to be changed so much that we won't be able to recognize it. Simply stated, no knowledge equals no development. And building capacity for developing countries is very important because that's still the vast majority of humanity. The Inter-Academy Council, I had the privilege of co-chairing that, produced that, the views of all the scientists, this is myself and Jacob Pallis, presenting it on behalf of the science communities to the UN, and we had this cluster of information about policy, human resources, etc. But if technology is going to happen, we have to trust our youth. And in the US, they have something called venture capitalists in a big way. In most of Africa and in the developing world, we don't. And I like to show these are people who invest pennies in order to reap billions later on. I show this picture, and I say, do you know who this is? Actually, this is Microsoft 1978, and there's Bill Gates. My question is, if a group of kids, long-haired, disheveled like that, came to one of our rich people in our societies and said, you know, we have this crazy idea, this wild idea of something called Windows, and it's going to change the world. And all we need is $2 million. Would they have invested? How about Facebook? Who would have invested? Etc. So we must have confidence in our youth. But whatever the current problem or the current reality, the change is happening with incredible speed. It's the dawn of a new age, and we must embrace it. Thank you.